Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. A couple of months ago on the show, we spoke with Liz Grimes, who created a program with her husband called Tatum's Totes. The couple turned the loss of their five-month-old child into a program that benefits foster children across the state. Well, May is National Foster Care Month, and I thought it would be a good time to revisit the subject and meet a couple important people involved in this care, one which is a foster parent, the other works at the Department for Children and Families. They'll be with me all hour to share their stories, explain what foster care can provide for a child, and what the needs are in the state right now. First, allow me to introduce Ann Ward, one of Vermont's wonderful foster care providers. Ann, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And next is Joan Rock. Joan is a foster and kin care manager for DCF's Family Services Division. Joan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me as well. Thank you.
Sure. Now, Joan, this is a big topic, and I want to wade into it as logically as I can, make sure that we answer as many questions that I know people will have on the subject. So let's start with explaining why a child in Vermont would need foster care.
Well, there are a variety of reasons why children would need to come into foster care. Abuse or neglect are two primary reasons, truancy from school. A lot of social factors interfere with families' ability to safely care for children, and some of these things interfere with their lives and create the need for children to come into foster care.
What efforts are made to keep a child with their own family?
Our primary goal is to keep children with their families, and we try to work on prevention services initially. We do a lot of work with the families to put supports in place, and even when the children come into custody, we are putting supports in place for that family to address whatever needs they have in order to safely reunify with their children.
Now, Joan, what would be an instance or several instances of why DCF would absolutely have to remove a child and place them in foster care?
If a child was had a significant injury, if a child was failing to thrive due to neglect, if a child was a threat to the community in some instances, maybe committing some illegal activity or being outside of the control of their parents, those are the primary reasons why children come into custody.
Ann Ward, when did you first become a foster parent?
Back in 2012.
And why did you make the decision to do so?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, but I grew up wanting to be a foster parent one day. I planned to start when I was old and gray and post-career, but one day in my 20s, I just made the decision to look and see what it would look like, and now I know where all my gray hairs are coming from.
Well done. So when you looked into it, you know, what was it that said, this is the right thing now for me?
You know, there are children out there. There's a list on DCF's website of children who are looking for homes. You can go and see that they're individual humans with likes and dislikes and fears and hopes and joys, and just being able to imagine the kids in our community that needed support and the families that need support. And I wasn't sure that I had what it took. But I wanted to try to offer children safety and to work with families to support being back together.
Well, I wondered about that, Anne. How confident were you when that first child came to stay with you?
Oh, you know, not at all. I wasn't even a parent at that point. You know, this was my first experience parenting. Of course, I babysat and things, and people come to foster care a lot of different ways, but I really had to learn as I went. And there's quite a bit of training, but I took the leap, and I had a fantastic resource coordinator at the time, support at DCF, to really help guide what it meant to be a foster family and how to support a child who'd experienced such incredible trauma.
How many children have you fostered?
30.
Wow. Wow, congratulations. That's since 2012, which is really an incredible number when you think of it. How long are they usually in your care?
You know, kids can be in care anything from one night to years. And I work with children 0 to 18, 19, and it depends on what the family need is. And sometimes the situation that causes the need to come into care is able to be resolved really quickly. Other times you have a child for a couple of days, a couple of weeks or months while a relative or other close community member is identified as a kinship care provider, and the child transitions to them. And sometimes you have children all the way through until adoption.
So, number one, you weren't quite ready. At what point did you know, out of 30, all right, I've got this. I'm now very confident. This is a loving home. I know how to do this.
Not. Every kid is so different. You know, I know fundamentally I have some really, I consider myself at this point a professional parent. Like I've done the training and there's so much, but every child is different. Every child's an individual. And that means continuing to learn and grow and never thinking that you know exactly what you're doing. And that you're the answer for these children or these families. Families are very complex, and we have to be able to move and adapt with their needs. Hmm.
Joan Rock, how many children are in foster care in Vermont currently?
Around 1,100 right now.
Mm-hmm. And then how many foster, kin, and respite families do you have in Vermont?
We are fortunate to have about 1,500 right now.
Wow.
But I have to qualify that with saying that we always need more.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many diverse needs of children, and we need equally as many diverse families to meet those needs.
Yeah. And we'll discuss how people can go about that as the show goes on. I do want, Joan, to make sure everyone understands the difference between the terms that we've used. And I'll start with, and these are, you know, foster, kin, and respite. So let's start with foster. What exactly does that entail?
Foster care is, or a foster parent is how we look at it, is a general applicant. They are not related to the child and typically do not have a previous relationship with the child or family. Kinship care is a relative, or it could be a term that we use as fictive kin. It could be someone that is known or has a previous relationship with the child and is connected to that child and family in some way. So it's either a relative or someone known to the child for kinship care. Respite care is short term. It's to give the family, the foster family, and the child a reprieve from each other, to give them a short break. It gives the child the opportunity to be outside of their normal routine, and it also allows them to be introduced to a new household and to understand that, you know, every household operates differently, but every household has some structure and rules and consistency and boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ann Ward, you mentioned, you know, that you're never quite 100% confident yet because each child is different. But I think you know now, what is it that makes a good foster parent?
Oh, that's, you know, I could say things like patience and flexibility and good communication skills.
Mm-hmm.
Those are things, but I also know that I didn't start out with those, and sometimes they're still in short supply. But what's really important is to be able to constantly learn and adapt and listen, and to understand that each of us has a culture inside our homes, inside our families, and that these children also have cultures inside their homes and families, and our ability to recognize the need for safety and belonging and ability to be exactly who you are as that child and have that feel safe and welcome. So that means, you know, not expecting children to have the same religious experience as you or like the same foods or same activities, and being able to provide an environment that feels good and feels as close to what their family values are as possible.
You mentioned that when you became a foster parent for the first time, you didn't have any children of your own. Do you mind if I ask, do you have children now?
I have adopted two children.
Oh, wonderful. So have you learned from being a foster parent those skills needed to be a parent?
Yes. But I keep learning. Again, you know, every child is different. Parents of multiples know you learn more and more with each one.
And what has been, for you, the most rewarding aspect of being a foster parent?
It's tough. There are so many. I mean, really, it's the tiny moments with children. It's those moments of connection and safety, and when you experience that a child is trusting you or having a sense of safety. But I also really love being part of the team. It's hard to do it, but every time a family comes in, children come into care, there's a whole team of people, and that's, you know, it includes DCF, and there's a guardian ad litem, and there might be other foster families on the team if the child has siblings and they weren't all placed together, and then service providers and people coming together and working really, really hard to support the kids and the families. Developing those community relationships and connections, I think, is really, really valuable. And now we have in Central Vermont just a really incredibly connected association of foster parents who lean on each other for support and learning as well.
And Joan, can you explain what guardian ad litem is in this regard?
Sure. A guardian ad litem is the person that is a party to the court that speaks to what is in the best interest of the children.
We're spending this. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to differentiate. An attorney speaks to what the child wants for their plan. The guardian ad litem, it speaks to what is in the best interest of the child.
And that is a volunteer position, correct?
Yes, it is.
Excellent. Yep. Joan, right before the break, I asked Ann about what it takes to be a good foster parent and the qualities that someone needs to have to do it well. From your perspective, how would you answer that question?
I think that Ann answered that beautifully. I think that there does need to be a level of flexibility and patience and adaptability. And I think that to be a good foster parent, you really need to be able to be comfortable with asking questions. You need to ask questions, and you need to do as much training as possible so that you can feel more confident and competent with parenting the child. I think that Anne's words around incorporating the child into your home and providing that sense of belonging is so important to the children that we serve. I also think that keeping kids local is really important. So having as many foster parents in each community to serve the children that are in need is a very important thing that we need to talk about as well.
Yeah, let's talk about that. How close do you try to keep the children to their families geographically?
Well, so our ultimate goal would be to keep the children in their same school mm-hmm. and in their same community, to keep as much familiar to them as possible. Keeping things familiar to children really helps to mitigate the trauma that they experience when they're separated from their families and have experienced some form of abuse. And so something like changing schools can be very traumatic to a child after they come into custody because they don't have that go-to teacher or the guidance counselor to go and consult with. And they're separated from their friends. So keeping them in their community keeps as much in their life as normal as possible. They can still participate in extracurricular activities in the school. They still can frequent the same grocery store. And it is important to be close to their family members and see family on a regular basis.
And Joan, are there restrictions, I don't know, such as being a single or a certain age to becoming a foster parent?
Well, you must be 21 years of age to be a licensed foster parent, and you must be 18 years of age to be a respite provider. But we need all types of families, single, married, gay, lesbian, different from different cultural diversities. We do have a lot of cultural diversity in Vermont now, mm-hmm. and so we need families from those areas as well to support the kids.
And then what type of background investigation do you do for potential foster parents?
Well, it's pretty rigorous. We run a lot of background checks. We run criminal background checks, and we ask a lot of questions. We do what's called a home study. Our residential licensing and special investigations unit is the unit that licenses foster parents. So initially, a resource coordinator would interview a foster parent and provide them with information so that they can make the decision, knowledgeably make a decision to become a foster parent. And then there's an orientation training that also can support them to become a foster parent and in making that decision.
And Ward, you go into each of these fostering situations with the understanding, you know full well, that the goal is for these children to return to their parents. How difficult is that?
Oh, that should be the goal. That should be the goal for foster families as well. It really means we work on that as well. And that's not easy. I don't want to make that sound like it feels good or in every case that feels right. But we have a system here. We have a system in our community, in our culture, in our laws that prioritizes separating families over the work of addressing the root causes of violence and poverty, incarceration, substance use, and the ongoing disenfranchisement of BIPOC and LGBTQ families. We have to participate in a way that heals those wounds as best as possible. You know, we're part of that system. It's a traumatic system, but it's what we have, and it's the choice our community has made instead of investing in prevention and in supporting families. And so our goal, anytime is not to take this child away and change their life and their culture and their family. It's to help minimize the trauma as much as possible, provide safety, and do the work of healing our community. Now, that's all fine and good, but when you're actually looking at this perfect, amazing little child, that can be really hard to sit with that the whole time and continue working with the family. And so there are a lot of feelings and experiences that you have, and it doesn't always work. And sometimes when families reunify, you don't feel good about it. You don't think it's the right thing. You're worried about the safety of that child. But ultimately, the work of healing our community is in keeping families together when it's safe.
And you've stressed the need for flexibility. And with each child that you foster, what kind of adjustments must be made on your part and on the child's part?
If people can imagine that first time that they had a sleepover in their youth,
yeah.
And how exciting that was potentially, it depends on your experience, but maybe how you looked forward to that, but also how challenging it was. And even if you wanted to be there, that families sleep differently. They have different bedtimes. They might have the wrong brand of cereal that you've never tried. And all of those things really, really make a difference. But it also means working on a child's or youth's clock. So there are moments of sadness and moments of connection and moments of experiencing love and belonging that we have to slow down for and be ready for and open to. And that can be really tough I know when I started, I was a very, you know, logistics person. Like, I have to be here at this time and here at this time, and my calendar is very important. Mm-hmm. And there are elements of me that are still pretty intense that way. But the ability to step back and say, what's really important right now in this person's life? What do I do? What do I need to do right now for this person who has needs that far exceed my own?
We have to remember, too, that these children have been taken from what they're comfortable with, their home, their family. So, and do some of them come into your household with some resentment, anger for being there and not with their parents?
Absolutely. Yes. Foster care is not necessarily a warm and fuzzy experience. It depends, you know, it depends on the child, but... you know, I'm definitely not an I love every child immediately kind of person, and definitely they are not either. It takes time and connection and safety to create those bonds, and it could take years. And so, especially older children who have been through, you know, families with generations of trauma and experiences, they don't know what to expect from you. You're not trustworthy. You're not safe. You're inherently one other threat. And that means communicating at that child's level of understanding and being ready to experience conflict and to be ready to have somebody living in your home who deeply hates you. And you know, that feeling, some teens, they can just radiate that through the walls. But I think that's true for all families, right? Even families with biological children, as parents, we have to expect times when our children do not trust us or love us or want to be around us. And that's actually a biological part of growing up, is that rejection of the need for family, for parents.
Yeah. So true. We're going to take another break. We've got the CBS News update, and then we're going to come back and continue our conversation on foster care with Ann Ward and Joan Rock. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and we're spending this hour discussing foster and kin care in Vermont. With me are Ann Ward and Joan Rock, and we're getting the perspective of a foster care provider and a manager in the Family Services Division of DCF, and that's Joan Rock. Joan, is there usually an attempt made to have children stay with relatives or kin before they're taken to a foster family?
Absolutely. We do try to do what we call family finding, and we have a variety of ways to try to locate family members of the children who come into custody once they're in custody. And prior to custody, we do things called family safety planning meetings to try to help the children remain with their families in a safe environment. And we learn a lot about their family through that process and identifying family member support to the family where the children may or may not come into custody. So we learn about family members throughout the process, and if it becomes necessary for the children to come into custody, we do try to identify a family member, again, for that familiarity for the child. They will be more successful if they are placed with family in a more familiar environment.
And through that process, you're trying to keep the child there with the family as much as possible. What's the tipping point generally that you have to say, we have to make a move, this child, these children have to be taken and put in a safer environment?
I'm going to say typically that there's a breaking point. There is an incident that occurs that puts it over the edge and requires us to write an affidavit and request custody from the court. It's usually an incident. It could be, though, if we are working with a family and we have tried for several months to help support them to mitigate the risks that are imposed upon the child, the reasons why we're involved, and if those are not successfully mitigated, then there are times where it becomes necessary to bring a child into custody so that the family can work on their issues while the child is not present with them.
And then how quickly does DCF move then to remove a child from that situation?
It always depends upon the circumstances. There's just so many different types of circumstances that we work with. If it's an injury to a child or a significant risk to the child, then we will act immediately. If it's an issue that we think we could maintain some safety in the home and have the child remain at home, we will attempt to do that with supports in place. And as I mentioned, it depends. Sometimes the families will make strides of progress and then maybe regress, and that regression may be the incident that creates the need for a child to enter custody.
When a child is removed, Joan, what are they able to take with them?
Whatever the family is willing to send with them, they can take most of their clothing and their school supplies and their favorite blankets or toys that they have. We prefer that they bring as much with them as possible. There are sometimes, and I'm sure you listeners can understand this, that families are very angry at family services, even if they have been, even if we have been working with them and explaining to them what needs to change within their family to create the safety that's necessary. They still, if we have to write that affidavit and ask the court for custody, then they still may be very angry at us, and they may withhold the child's belongings because they're angry at family services. Mm-hmm. It's hard for them to understand that what would be in the best interest of the child is to have what's familiar at that moment. There are times when we can circle back around and get more of the child's belongings at a later date when things calm down.
Well, Ann Ward, when I spoke with Liz Grimes, who started Tatum's Totes, because so often there were children who would show up with very little. Is that what you've seen in some of the situations you've been involved with?
Yes, most of the children who have come to my home have very little with them, and Tatum's Totes makes a big difference in that initial drop off. You know, there are times when we can get a call and say yes to a child coming to your home, and you don't have time to go out and buy things.
Right.
The social worker's on the way already.
Yeah.
With the child. So having, enough diapers to get through the night and, a pacifier or some clothing or things really, really makes a difference. That's also another way that communities can support children and support foster families, is when they know that their friend or neighbor or somebody is taking in a child, to offer to go and do that initial shop, that let's get some basics. Most foster families keep, extra toothbrushes and a variety of diapers, depending on the age they're supporting, and various things at home. But there's always something more that a child needs in that first, crisis couple of nights.
Mm-hmm.
Before you can really shop with the child to ask them.
Yeah, I wondered what items you might keep on hand since you've been through this, so many times now.
I have closets. I have bins. I have most things. And again, it gets you through the first couple of nights for sure. And some things last and work with a variety of children. But what's also important is that kids aren't just wearing, other kids' clothing or secondhand stuff all the time, that especially older youth have the opportunity to go shopping and to find what they feel good wearing and what they want to wear and experience and the things that matter to them.
Yeah. And Joan, how does DCF help augment that?
The resource coordinator in the office or the recruitment and retention specialist is typically the liaison with Tatum's Totes or any other support to foster families in this way. So when a child is coming into custody, the resource coordinator will connect with Tatum's Totes or whatever other organization is in their area to provide things, like Ann said, the diapers, a toothbrush, a hairbrush, just the very simple basic necessities. And these things are given to the child so that they can call them their own. And I think that is a significant piece to this, is that they actually have something that they can call their own when they first arrive at the foster home, and they don't have to rely upon these strange people to provide every last thing for them immediately. And I agree with Ann that it's really, really important for children to be able to go out shopping and have their own belongings at that point too. Oftentimes, even if we get clothing or other items from the family members, there are times when some of the clothing doesn't fit, or maybe it's worn, and the children really are in need of updated belongings.
And Joan, how can someone find out about what groups in their community are providing these kind of services?
By contacting your local resource coordinator. Tatum's Totes really is a statewide program, yeah. So Tatum's Totes is in all communities. There are other smaller organizations and local communities that might be able to contribute either to Tatum's Totes or individually to foster families.
Gotcha. Joan, this year's theme for Foster Care Month is about working with and empowering youth. Why is that so important to incorporate the voice of the youth that are served?
Well, anyone who has raised teens know that they can be a bit independent, and they often know what they want for themselves. So it's critical to incorporate their voice in future planning. They will be far more invested in the positive outcomes if they're participating in their planning. And a while ago, we made a video back in 2014, but to me, it's still very relevant today. The title of the video was "No Decision About Me Without Me." And I think this is the thinking that we all need to have within our system when we're working with youth and their families. Youth will experience things differently if their voice is heard. And even if there's disagreement and the need to compromise, they'll have a better understanding about what is happening in their lives. And with that comes a greater commitment to be successful in a foster home or in life in general. Developmentally, because of their trauma, sometimes they're a little bit regressed socially or academically. Maybe they haven't had the experiences of a child not in custody that would equal their chronological age. And so they're making up for things that they missed out on when they're still growing up. So that developmental process of becoming independent when they're teenagers is more complicated for youth in care, because they may not have had that nurturing and guidance that they needed as they developed. And now they're trying to separate from adults and become more independent. So it's a lot more complicated for the youth to experience that in teens.
Yeah, and how do you help the foster and kin care providers to give that support and prepare these teens for adulthood?
Well, there's a couple of things that we do. First of all, there's a great training program. I mentioned the orientation. Well, there's a required training for foster caregivers, foster and kin caregivers. That helps them to become trauma-informed caregivers, so they learn ways to respond to children that are very sensitive to what the children need. We talk a lot about foster parents needing to provide that listening ear, someone who's not going to freak out about the language that comes out of children's mouths. and someone who understands the term of what testing really means. And all of this is covered in that training. But after the training, when a child is actually residing with a foster family and they're experiencing these things, the family services worker or the resource coordinator or a member of that team. Anne talked about children coming into custody and a team forms around these children. A member of that team may be supporting the foster family in terms of how to interact with the child to be the most successful with that child.
And I think in addition to the orientation, there's a mentoring program that's available. Foster parents who have been through this can help those who are learning. Am I right about this?
Yes, I'm one of the state's mentors, and that means, you know, new families who are coming in and have questions about how to navigate the system. I get matched with a family and support them the best I can, which is challenging because every family and family situation is different, but we all experience, you know, many of the same emotions and responses to what's happening in our lives and the lives of the children. So it's really great to have each other.
Did you go through that as a mentee before you were a mentor?
I didn't. I think I was in the first class of trained mentors.
Ah, okay. All right. A trailblazer. Well done, Anne. All right. Joan, how many of the foster parents do utilize this mentoring program?
Right now we have about, I think it's about 86 mentors and about 40 mentees that are currently active. This is a relatively new program in the state of Vermont. We have tried to stand it up over the last, I think it's about 5 years. And so I don't honestly know the total number of mentors and mentees over the 5 years, but I can, that's the information that I have that's current.
Good. Yeah. And Joan, why does the Department of Children and Families need so many foster and kin care providers?
We need a variety of foster and kin care providers because we have so many different children and youth of all different experiences and ages, infants, toddlers, young children and teens, children with complex medical needs, sibling groups. We need foster families in these children's local communities to be trained and prepared and licensed and ready to have these children come into their homes. And so we need as many varied foster parents as we have varied children in our system.
And Joan, is adoption an option in some cases, or I guess I should ask it a different way as well, in what cases is adoption an option in these foster situations?
So after a period of time, and I'm going to say generally speaking, that period of time is about a year, and we are not seeing that the family is making the steps to provide a safe environment for their children in their home, we are starting to look at where this child is going to be, where this child's permanency needs are going to be met. And typically, if we are changing the case plan goal to a termination of parental rights and subsequently adoption, then we would start that process by asking the current foster family if they are willing to adopt a child. Yeah. And oftentimes, we know this well in advance of the case plan goal changing. Mm-hmm. There's discussions, there's typically monthly meetings, so we hope that nothing is a surprise to the foster parents as they move through this process.
Gotcha.
So that's an instance where a foster parent could adopt is if the family is unsuccessful at the reunification efforts and we need to follow through with providing permanency for the child.
And you've fostered 30 children. I'd love for you to share a successful experience. I know you can't provide, specific details about a child you've had, but can you tell us, a really successful experience that you've had with at least one of the children?
Sure. I've had a number of what I would consider really successful experiences, but One stands out. I had a little toddler come to me. He had a number of siblings, and somebody sort of offhand said, "Don't fall in love, because you know, this child will probably go home in the next couple of weeks. You know, this is, the family needs support, and we'll make it happen." And then he can reunify, and the siblings can reunify. And while this part is not successful, you know, it took almost a year and a half. And that has a lot to do with, you know, the challenges that our families face in our community, and the barriers that are put in place to clawing your way out of poverty, and addressing education and mental health needs and basic needs like shelter and heat and food. It's very hard. It's very hard to do that when your household size changes. And so in this case, the community, many community programs, social service programs came together to support the family. I think Capstone Community Action and Central Vermont Humane Society got involved and just really pulled together and said, this family needs to be together. And what was successful about it was just the amount of love and connection that we were able to maintain through that really long stay, almost a year and a half, and then returning, and the intensity of the bond between this family. And I still just have so much admiration, and I hope they're listening, for how they showed up for as a family, how they showed their children love and connection, and that steady promise of we're going to be here, and we're going to make this work, and we're going to fight because we love you and we want to be with you. And I learned so much from them about love and how to show up as a family that now I bring, you know, to my children and to other children coming into care. And while it was challenging and you know, concerns remain, it was such a beautiful thing to see those siblings be reunited with their family who loves them and wants to maintain that intensity of love and community. Mm. It was really beautiful.
Beautiful. Joan, we only have about a minute left, but I do want to make sure that people understand how they can go about, how they can inquire, start the process of becoming a foster care provider.
Sure. The quickest and easiest way to find out more about foster care is to visit our website at www.dcf.vermont.gov/fostercare. There you would find a link to an inquiry form that you could fill out, and that would be sent to the local district, and then the resource coordinator or recruitment and retention specialist would reach out. The other way is to call the district office directly and let them know that you're interested in fostering. And again, the resource coordinator or recruitment and retention specialist would be in touch with them.
All right.
And we welcome those calls.
Beautiful.
And those inquiry forms.
And that's dcf.vermont.gov/fostercare. That's Joan Rock, and she is the foster and kin care manager for the Department for Children and Families, Family Services Division, and Ann Ward is one of Vermont's wonderful foster care providers. I want to thank you both for the work you do and for being on the program this morning.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Yep. Take care now. We're going to break for CBS News, and then when we come back, we're going to hear about Create VT. And a reminder that today at 1 on WDEV, we'll have the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's followed by The Getaway with Greg Hooker from 2 to 4. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. We're getting close to that time when we can emerge from our pandemic-induced cocoons, and when we do, it'll be smart to look back on the role the arts played in helping us get through this. Things we were able to experience virtually or from a distance, And also the yearning we've had to attend live performances and museums in person. In the past 14 months, I think most of us have learned that the arts do matter a lot. Well, just over a week ago, a roadmap for critical investment in Vermont artists, creative entrepreneurs, and businesses was launched. It's called Create VT Action Plan. Here to help us walk through the plan is Vermont Arts Council Executive Director Karen Middleman. Karen, it's great to have you back on the program.
Great to be here, Vic.
Thank you. And Vermont Creative Network Steering Committee Chair Jody Freed. Jody, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Sure thing. And listeners, if you have a question or a comment about the plan, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's our toll-free number. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jody, can you talk about how the Create VT Action Plan came about?
Yeah, it's been a very extended and inclusive process over the past. It started almost 3 years ago in terms of the work on the ground and the studies that were done. We did a study in the Northeast Kingdom, which then acted as a stepping stone for the larger statewide work. And we did a study with Mount Auburn Associates for the state, and that then created the framework and the necessary background information, data on how essential the arts are in Vermont. And from there, we then opened it up, and over the course of the past year, have been having virtual gatherings. We've brought together thousands of people over that time period to get their input, from artists to small business owners to regional planners to leaders in different roles throughout the state, and based on their input and the data that we had from those reports, we were able to create this amazing roadmap forward.
So what was the point where you said, okay, we've been collecting all this data, it's time we now turn it into a report?
Yeah, so this is something that's been going on for a long, long time. I mean, it started really a decade ago, the recognition that the creative economy was something special in Vermont. And the question was, how do you build the vehicle to tell that story? And figuring out what that data is to collect. And this has been evolving around the country as well. And so we felt like as we got to 2016, that there was enough of this work being done on a national basis that we could then bring that framework into Vermont. And that's when we reached out for help to Mount Auburn Associates and some of the other players that did this research for us, because they had been doing this work in cities across the country and in rural communities across the country. So there were some markers and some comparative analysis that could be done as to how did Vermont stack up against other locations across the country, and what were those key indicators that we needed to be looking at if we were going to build a plan that was based around facts and data and ultimately be effective long term.
Karen Middleman, there are so many Vermonters working in the creative industries, both professionally and formally. So how did you survey them? How do you make sure, you know, that you were getting to most of them to have input on this this plan?
You're absolutely right. There are so many people working in the creative sector and part of the creative sector that it's a little hard to get our arms around. We looked at economic data, we looked at job data, we did field surveys and focus groups. What most people don't realize is just how many jobs fall into the creative sector. In Vermont, it's about 41,000 jobs. It's 9.3% of all employment in our state falls into creative sector enterprises. That's art galleries, theaters, museums, graphic design firms, artists and cheese shops, film studios, manufacturers, and all of the jobs that are required to support those enterprises. So in a theater, you have the actors who are on stage and the director and the people who paint the curtains and the scenery, but you also have the ticket takers and the custodians and the security guards. All of those count as creative sector jobs. and they add up to a really substantial part of Vermont's economy. And also, frankly, it's a big part of what makes our communities vibrant and strong and great places where people want to live and work.
So that's a lot of people.
There was a moment.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, you asked an interesting question. What was the moment when we realized this needed to turn from research into a study or a report? There was a moment when our researchers, Mount Auburn Associates, who Jody mentioned, were kind of stunned by the data, the numbers that they were churning. They were in the middle of looking at the proportion of jobs in the Northeast Kingdom that were in the creative sector, and it was, Jody, I can't remember, it was between 9% and 10% in the NEK, right? And they just
it was right around 9%.
Right, and they turned to us and said, for a small, rural, isolated state, Vermont has an extraordinarily vibrant creative sector. I mean, they do nationwide creative economy research, and they were stunned by what they were finding in our state. And that was one of those aha moments when that just ratified what Vermonters already know, which is that our creative sector really matters when we think about Vermont's future, whether we're thinking about our economic future or just our the cultural and social life of our community. So as we map out the future of Vermont, the creative sector needs to be front and center, and that's what the Create VT Action Plan is all about.
Well, Karen, what are some of the input that you received?
So in the strategy sessions and idea jams online that Jody was talking about that we've been doing over the past few years, we did online surveys as well. We looked at where the creative sector jobs are, and we also looked at what kinds of support do artists and creatives and creative entrepreneurs need to thrive. One of the things that the action plan does is it points to areas where if we want the creative sector to grow, we want Vermont to thrive, we need to make some serious investment. And so that was one of the most critical kinds of feedback that we got from the field. We asked people, what do you need? And, you know, a lot of the answers that we got won't be surprising to your listeners. Artists and creative businesses need financial skills training. They need financial support in the form of tax credits for downtown arts and culture centers and music festivals. We need to rebuild our aging cultural infrastructure. We need increased investment in direct grants for public art and for cultural events and performances so that they can happen. Those creative businesses, in order to thrive, they need the same kind of support that all businesses need. They need marketing expertise, financial skills training, and we need to also mentor the next generation of creative entrepreneurs. We need to make sure that our educational system is building the skills, the creative skills that are essential for the next generation to step up into those businesses. So there's a whole range of needs from direct grants and investment in downtown theaters and to supporting our downtown food festivals and sculptures in public parks or along rail trails. Thinking about all of the ways that art and creativity add vibrancy to our community. Basically what this plan is saying is we need to be looking at what Vermont could look like in the future if we placed art, culture, and creativity at the center of our state's way forward. So if you're thinking about the future of your town and the select board's meeting to map out a five-year plan, there should be an artist on that planning commission, or two or three voices from the creative sector who can bring their creative ideas and the inspiration and insights of the art into mapping the way forward.
Jody, Karen mentioned that a lot of, you know, what you learned weren't necessarily surprises, but were there some responses that really did surprise you with their answers and you thought, man, I wish I had thought of that?
Yeah, so one of the real surprises that came up early in this process was as we looked at how does this impact the future of Vermont and where we're going and really our ability to differentiate ourselves in the future. And, you know, we're facing in Vermont these really large demographic challenges as our baby boomer workforce is retiring, and we're going to need to be bringing in the younger workforce, whether that's our youth staying here or them moving in from outside. And really, the experts will tell you we're going to have folks coming here in order to fill the large gap from folks who are retiring. And as we look at that, one of the key components in attracting younger workforce is this creativity in downtowns, is the communities that are based around creativity. It's an essential quality that the younger workforce, they don't consider it optional. They're not going to move. They're looking for experience in their life, and vibrancy and creativity in terms of them choosing where they're going to live, work, and play is essential. And so as we think about the future of Vermont and where we're going to be headed over the course of the next 10, 20, 30 years, it became really clear to me that if we don't embrace this, if we don't start investing in this, if we don't make this a clear path forward for the entire state, that we're just not going to be able to backfill the jobs that are leaving the state right now as people are aging out of the economy and retiring. So that was a real moment for me as to the just the necessity of this and really the opportunity, because it's interesting when you look at the data, the other things that young workforce look for is they look for outdoor recreation. They look for local foods and a sense of community. So really, if we can embrace this creativity and have a plan, it could be for the state of Vermont an opportunity to really address the workforce issues of the future and our future economy here in the state.
Jody, let's talk about what are some of the plan's action items?
Yeah, so Karen touched on a few of these, but the idea of getting involved at a very local level, and I can speak to this in the Northeast Kingdom and working with towns in terms of their town plans and developing the leadership there. The other action items, you know, some of them are around the resources programs that can provide funding, both public funding and private funding, how do we bring the dollars to the table that have such an incredible return on investment? I talk with folks all the time that, you know, the arts, culture, and creativity are just this really incredible organic fertilizer, and we can sprinkle it on just about anything we do in our communities, and it makes it more vibrant. It attracts more people. It attracts more commerce. It not only makes it a better place to live, but it also brings prosperity. And with very minimal investment, we can do that across so many different parts of our towns, across our downtowns. And so that idea of bringing resources to the table. Other action items are building out the network, because one of the things we heard in these meetings that we had was just how incredibly powerful it was for the artist on one side of the state to connect with the filmmaker on another side of the state, to all of a sudden have a regional planner or somebody chiming in that there were resources available, and just those connections. So how do you create a robust network so those connections can happen on their own? So those are a few items. I mean, there's actually a number of them that are built out, but they fall along those kind of major categories of how do we tell the story and bring more people into the fold, the advocacy piece of it, and make sure everybody understands what this means? Because for some folks, as we talk about the creative economy, this is new language, and we need to make sure everybody understands it because it's so important for our future. And then there's these discussions around resources, and then there's discussions around the networking. So if you look at the plan, it's broken out, and it's got these nine goals that fall under three categories of, and it's organized in a way that just about anybody can pick up the two-pager and really make sense of it, because it's very intuitive.
I love that image of the arts being organic fertilizer here in Vermont. Well done, Jody. Karen, how will this plan affect Vermont and Vermonters?
Well, you know, one of the things I was thinking as I listened to Jody is something that all of your listeners can do is tap into the local agenda for grassroots action that's embedded in this plan. There are local creative economies in every town, village, and county in Vermont. some are more developed and more vibrant and more active than others, but there's potential everywhere to promote your local creative economy. And just, I'll throw out a few examples. In White River Junction, community members are turning a vacant parking lot into a space for outdoor dining and film screenings in the evenings. In Barton and NEK, they're building a community outdoor amphitheater connected to a garden for community members and a network of trails along the river. So this project will offer performing arts, connections to the Barton River, and also is addressing food insecurity in the community by providing easily available, nourishing food through the garden. Those are really local grassroots examples of partnerships, community partnerships that foster a local, strong local creative economy. It's one of the kind of three hubs of our Create VT Action Plan. We've identified three paths forward. One of them is a statewide advocacy agenda to secure the investment and resources, financial resources that Jody was mentioning. The second is the network building agenda to keep creatives connected to each other and empower them through resources and training and an active online resource hub. And the third is a kind of local grassroots action that we're going to continue to support through the creative network, but really is ultimately up to community members to design and activate for their own communities.
Well, interesting you bring those up, Jody. Karen. On Monday, I had a couple of members of Waterbury Arts on the show to talk about a project they're calling Phoenix Rising, and it'll be a beautiful painting on the side of a building here, but kind of a way to start, really expanding the arts here in Waterbury. A few months ago, I talked to the group in Lindenville who are taking empty storefronts and making sure that art is displayed there, and they have a gallery in the town there. So it certainly can be fostered, in that on that grassroots level. Jody, is this something that other states have undertaken, an action plan, a statewide action plan for the arts like you've now done here in Vermont?
You know, I think our plan is pretty unique. So other states have brought in consultants. In many of them, it was the same consultants that we used, Mount Auburn Associates, initially. And they've created a plan, but it's been really created by the consultants based on interviews and their research. I think what we added here was this component of a really extensive engagement process within the arts, culture, and creativity community. So those thousands of folks that participated in those roundtable discussions on Zoom and filled out those surveys and the really connecting with the folks that are doing this work in the state, I think that's unique to our plan, and there may be others out there, but by combining those two things, we have a plan that not only looks at the landscape and of the whole country and the creative economies that we're kind of modeling after or working parallel with, but it also looks right to the DNA of our local communities, to the folks that are functioning in this sector, and asked what they needed, what their vision was, and came, this is the culmination of all of that work. So I think this is a pretty unique plan, and I know that the group that's worked on it, one of the things that was just so important to us was just to make sure that this was inclusive, that it wasn't a top-down process, and that there was, engagement and the opportunity for folks working within the creative sector to be able, and within communities, because again, some of the participants in this were not necessarily artists or creatives, but were partners or allies or folks that were working in roles where there was a huge impact on them. So all of those voices are incorporated into this plan, and I think that makes it really unique.
Mm-hmm. There's only about a minute for each of you to do this, so I hope we can squeeze this in, but I'd love to hear any news from your individual organizations that you want to make sure people know about. Karen, I'll let you go first with the Vermont Arts Council.
Rick, I was really struck by the example of the mural of a phoenix rising from the ashes in Waterbury. Mm-hmm. There are studies of communities in crisis that talk about how important the arts are to help communities recover and heal. Art is really about resilience of the human spirit and healing our hearts and spirits after a very, very rough year. So our focus of the Vermont Arts Council over the next year is getting as many resources and as much support out to artists and arts organizations to help all of our communities recover and heal and come back stronger.
Thanks, Karen. And Jody with the Vermont Creative Network.
So the Vermont Creative Network is going to be very focused on how do we take this plan that we worked so hard on for so long build the infrastructure around the plan itself. So the how do we make sure that we have representation and communication going on? How do we make sure that the local regions are communicating so that as we move forward as a state, we're doing it in a collaborative and a cooperative way that, and that we make sure that, at the end of the day, all of these different points get addressed, that we don't have anything fall through the cracks. We have a lot of work to do. This is a jumping off point. We've done a lot of work to get to this point, but now the hard work of actually getting this done is going to be, I think, where we're focused.
I know you just released the plan, Jody, but is there a point, a date, a time you see as that jumping off point to start getting it rolling?
Yeah, I think that's already in play, Rick. We have, members of the steering committee, our zone agents, everybody right now, the first step is getting the plan out there and making sure that it's distributed widely. And then the next step will be rallying around that and figuring out how do we work together as a state to move it forward. So I think all of that is happening right now. And the first step is the communication piece and education piece of what the plan actually looks like and what it means.
Jody Fried is the Vermont Creative Network Steering Committee Chair. Karen Middleman is the Vermont Arts Council Executive Director. Thank you both for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. And tonight on WDEV, we're going to have Red Sox baseball as they take on the AL West leading Oakland A's. It's game two of the three-game series from Fenway. Coverage at 6:10, first pitch 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. There's been a number of education-related stories lately that have made the news, and that means VT Diggers education reporter Lola DeFore has been hard at work chasing them down. She joins us now to share what she's learned. Lola, it's always informative having you on the program. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Lola a question about her education reporting, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Now, Lola, I want to start with a story about yours that was entitled, Vermont Can't Discriminate Against Religious Schools, But Can Those Schools Discriminate Against Kids? Pretty compelling stuff. Tell us first about the school involved.
The school involved is a small Christian school based in Bennington. It's a K-12 school. I believe its enrollment is under 100 kids. In its student handbook, it has, some pretty conservative opinions about people who are trans and people who are gay. And says pretty explicitly that if you follow this quote unquote lifestyle, then, we don't particularly want you here. And this was actually pointed out by former Secretary of Education, in Vermont, Rebecca Holcomb, who has been following all of the litigation around, religious schools and our voucher program pretty closely. And this Bennington school is not the only Christian school in Vermont to have, you know, language like this in its student handbook, kind of explicitly saying certain types of children are and families are not welcome here. Although I do have to say that I took like a look at a lot of religious school student handbooks while I was researching the story, and they did seem to be outliers, right? It's not like most Catholic schools in Vermont have language anywhere near this in their own student handbooks.
In what way does this school receive state funding?
It gets funding through the child care subsidy program. So right now, if you are under a certain income, you can get subsidies for child care. And it has a child care program which accepts those subsidies.
So how have,
and,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No,
sorry.
Please.
And also the larger question is whether or not it could soon become eligible for the other major source of public funding to private schools in Vermont, which is Vermont's town tuitioning programs, town tuitioning program, which is basically our, you know, K-12 voucher system. If you live in a choice town where you can basically get, I want to say it's about $16,000 towards tuition, or Act 166, which is our preschool voucher program, which gives you the equivalent of 10 hours weekly of preschool.
And, Lola, how has a recent court ruling or rulings protected or benefited schools like Grace Christian?
Well, we have seen – so this kind of all started, well, a few years ago, but there was a Supreme Court ruling this summer called Espinoza versus, I think, the Montana Department of Revenue, some Montana state agency. In that ruling, it was a split ruling, the Supreme Court found that basically for a state to exclude a religious entity from a public program solely on the basis of that entity's religious status was unconstitutional, that it was discriminatory. So basically, and this was a school scholarship program, and they said, you know, you can't just deny a school who wants to participate in these public benefit programs just because they are religious. And what this ruling left open and was kind of silent on is whether or not the state could nevertheless put restrictions on what that money is used for. And that could be a distinction without a difference, or it could not. And that's a very big and important open question in Vermont, because while that court ruling basically knocked down so-called Blaine amendments, which are a type of constitutional amendment in state constitutions that basically created blanket bans on public money going to religious entities, it left open the possibility that states could still put guardrails around how that money was used. So basically, you can send money, potentially you can send money to, or you should, send money to religious entities if public entities are eligible for those funds. But you can also require that the money not be used for religious purposes. So basically, like, you can help a school, a parochial school, resurface their playground, but you can't pay the salary of, like, you know, a minister or, you know, their religious teacher. The big open question is whether or not that is a distinction that states are allowed to make, whether or not they can still put guardrails around how the money is used. And that's important in Vermont because we have this thing called the so-called compelled support clause, which has been interpreted to mean that the state can prohibit the use of public funds going towards directly towards religious worship or instruction. So the big open question in Vermont is whether or not, while the state can no longer just say, you know, Rice Memorial School, you're not eligible for, say, dual enrollment money, the big open question is whether or not it can still potentially say, you are not eligible for money that's going to pay directly for religious instruction. There have been a series of court rulings in federal court, which indicate that might indeed be a distinction without a difference, and that have told school districts in Vermont, actually, you have to just send tuition money. You know, you have been discriminating against these religious schools. The problem is the rulings that have come so far have been quiet about whether or not there is a possibility that we can still nevertheless regulate the money, that like our past practices have been incorrect because we were operating under a blanket ban, or whether or not, I'm sorry, this is very complicated.
It is, and I was going to compliment you on your work as a legal scholar, Lola, because it does get knotty and does get difficult to understand. And I think we'll leave it there for now. But I do want to know if Vermont's Agency of Education has issued any directives on tuition going to religious schools.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is they did, and then they took it back.
Mm-hmm.
So originally, they put out this guidance. This was in the midst of all this litigation, saying that school districts basically could release money to religious schools, but they needed to ask all schools just to self-certify that the money would not go to religious use. And then they pulled that guidance back. Right. So schools are actually operating without guidance from the Agency of Education, and they are operating without guidance so far from the state legislature. So it is kind of up to individual school districts who administer these funds to decide, like, where to draw this incredibly thorny constitutional line.
Mm. And this school, Grace Christian, is in Bennington. So have any of the area towns raised concerns about the school since the Holcomb tweet?
Not that I have heard of. They might have, but I haven't heard that they have.
All right. I'm going to shift to the higher education world. It has been a whirlwind couple of years for our state college system, from the merger renaming of Johnson State and Linden State to their merger, the recommendations of their closures. Now the state colleges could get $89 million from the legislature. First of all, how does that compare to budget allotments of the past?
Well, their historical appropriations, so what they usually get is about $30 million. Until kind of recently, it was like around 28, but, you know, around there. So in a typical year, they get about $30 million. So this is obviously more than double that.
It is indeed. So why the big bump?
Well, the big bump is because they are in crisis, and because of COVID, and because there is a ton of federal money in the state right now, which makes this this much easier to do. So as I'm sure most of your listeners have heard or seen, last spring was a bit of an existential moment for the state colleges. Their then chancellor proposed closing three campuses permanently, including all of Northern Vermont University. And ever since then, obviously that plan has been shelved. Spalding has resigned, but ever since then, the legislature and the state colleges have been thinking really hard about what they need and how they need to transform themselves in order to, you know, survive and remain viable entities.
Wow. So Jeff Spalding's idea, not necessarily popular, but it might have really shaken the tree for these state colleges that he was talking about shutting down. This money, because of COVID, so not sustainable, will probably slip back to the normal funding?
Yes. I mean, that's the big thing, is $89 million is a lot of money, and it looks like a lot of money. Some of that will be used over like 4 years, but the thing to really keep in mind when you look at this $90 million pot of money is that most of this is one time, right? It's just it's one time money. The only increase to their base appropriation for now is $5 million. So they're going to go from getting $30 million a year to getting $35 million a year. So the basic structure, the basic kind of like funding scheme that they're looking at from the state, that remains unchanged. And that's kind of important to keep in mind because Vermont has historically, since the 80s, has spent, you know, less on public higher ed than almost every other state in the country. And this, even though it's a huge amount of money, that doesn't really change that at all. This is a lot of money, but it's one time. So the kind of year-over-year ongoing operational budget that the state colleges can kind of count on in terms of state support, that's not really changing. And that's really important to keep in mind as we look at the transformations and the reforms that the colleges are embarking on, because the first assumption that the colleges are working with as they, you know, look at what they're going to do and how they're going to change is the fact that, you know, it does not look so far like the state is gonna pony up much more in the future. I mean, they might, but right now, they're keeping the basic funding structure as is.
The schools that Jeb Spalding had talked about closing were NVU Johnson, NVU Linden, and Vermont Technical College. Do we know how enrollment has been faring at those schools recently?
They have been going down. Well, VTC has been pretty solid, although the campus that he was thinking of closing had been under capacity for a long time, and had been, there's also like a lot of deferred maintenance at the VTC camp, at the Randolph campus that he was thinking of closing. So while VTC itself had been doing relatively well compared to, you know, it's kind of the more residential schools in the system, that particular campus was not, you know, generating a ton of revenue compared to its expenses. NVU has long been kind of the most ailing school in the system in terms of money. Its enrollment has been kind of steadily dwindling. And that's kind of not surprising just given the population it serves, right? It's in the most impoverished part of the state, and also the oldest part of the state. So there are ever fewer high school-aged graduates, kind of traditional, that traditional demographic that goes to college. And also, you know, the people in the NEK are even less likely to be able to pay the kind of tuition that the state colleges charge.
Mm-hmm. Especially with the modicum of support that those schools have been receiving. Now, there were two schools in the state college system, CCV, that was spared. The other is Castleton University. Now, Castleton's in the southern part of the state where we've lost, you know, they've lost near neighbors Green Mountain College, College of St. Joseph's, Southern Vermont College, and Marlboro College over the past few years. Have they seen any kind of bump in enrollment because of that?
They actually did. They have seen a small bump in enrollment. Or they had right around the time of those closures, so they did get a little bit of a shot in the arm that did benefit them. It's hard to know if that's going to be remain the case. Mm-hmm. Castleton's enrollment, you know, has gone down a little bit. It's definitely had some money troubles, but it has been much healthier than the other residential school in the system.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned Marlboro College, and I want to know what the latest is on the campus there, which becomes something called Degrees of Freedom.
Yes, yes, that was a very interesting story.
Yes.
Well, it's a very open question. What is going to happen to the campus now? The man who bought the campus, well, technically he didn't buy the campus, the nonprofit he was in charge of bought the campus, who bought the campus for almost no money, you know, had promised to remake higher education from the ashes of Marlborough College. It was going to be a college, you know, specifically for, or a higher education experience, he called it, specifically for low-income, marginalized students, you know, a lot of the population that he had started a charter school network prior to this in New York. So he was really thinking about that population of kids. And he was going to create this kind of hybrid college that was going to be like partly online and partly a residential experience where students would, and actually we have examples of this. Goddard College is a really good example, and sure. They've been doing this for decades, which is that most of your experience, you know, most of your degree you actually do from home, and then you travel to the campus for short stints.
And I think Vermont College of Fine Arts has followed that as well.
Yes, yes, you're right. So he was going to do this. He talked a huge game. He never bothered to get even basic regulatory approvals to operate a college. He ultimately partnered with this Florida-based school to actually, like, provide the quote-unquote college courses that he was going to offer. And then a couple weeks ago now, the feds came in and arrested him for wire fraud and money laundering, and accused him of stealing about $200,000 from the escrow accounts of the charter school network he operated. So everything is very much in limbo. I talked to the current CEO of the project, who said that, you know, their September opening was kind of on pause right now. So they seem to be on a kind of indefinite hiatus. In terms of, and meanwhile, there's a fight over who owns the campus, because this group had, after buying the campus, entered into this strange sale leaseback agreement with this Canadian businessman, and then that all fell apart before the feds even came in and arrested the public face of this project for financial crimes. So everything is very much in limbo. And, you know, we'll have to see where this goes next.
I shiver with anticipation on that one.
It's fascinating to watch, although I think the folks in Marlborough are, you know, incredibly upset that basically this kind of jewel of the community has been the subject of such turmoil and scandal.
Lola, we're going to have to leave it right there, and I apologize. We are out of time. But Lola DeFore is the education reporter for VT Digger. It's always great to get caught up on your reporting. Thanks so much for being on the show this morning, Lola.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro and directed by Danny McGivergan. And we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.